I want to talk to you tonight from the 22nd chapter of the Gospel of Luke. 22nd chapter of Luke. And beginning with verse 24. And we'll read through the 34th verse. 24 through 34. Luke chapter 22. You recognize that this is a part of what was going on in the upper room. Jesus is meeting with his disciples. And having the Passover supper just a few hours before he goes to the cross. And in verse 24, "And there was also a strife among them, which of them should be counted the greatest. And he said unto them, The kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and they that exercise authority upon them are called benefactors. But ye shall not be so, but he that is greatest among you, let him be as the younger, and he that is chief as he that serves. For which is greater, he that sitteth at meat or he that serves? Is not he that sits at meat? But I am among you as he that serves. You are they which have stayed with me in my tribulations. And I appoint unto you a kingdom, as my Father has appointed unto me, that you may eat and drink of my table in my kingdom, and sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. And the Lord said, Simon, Simon, behold, Satan has desired to have you, that he may sift you as wheat. But I have prayed for thee, that thy faith fail not. And when thou art converted, strengthen your brethren. And he said unto him, Lord, I am ready to go with thee both into prison and to death. And he said, I tell you, Peter, the cock will not crow this day before that thou wilt thrice deny that you know me." Now, again, verses 31 and 32, "And the Lord said, Simon, Simon, behold, Satan hath desired to have you, that he may sift you as wheat. But I have prayed for you, that your faith fail not, and when you are converted or turned again, when you regain your balance, strengthen your brethren." One of my favorite writers is a man by the name of C.S. Lewis. Some of you, I'm certain, are familiar with him and his writings. He's quite a prolific writer. I suppose he is best known as Screwtape Letters, which I think are just pure genius, in which he has an old veteran demon writing to his nephew, a rookie demon, telling him how best to deceive and defeat Christians. He was also quite a science fiction writer, very prolific man, intelligent man. I'm not certain if you would call him a philosophical theologian or a theological philosopher, but he was a tremendous teacher and taught at Oxford and Cambridge. Before C.S. Lewis became a Christian, he was what we would probably call an agnostic, an atheist. After he was saved some years later, he wrote an autobiographical account of his spiritual experience, and he entitled it Surprised by Joy. I've always been intrigued by that title, for I think it's a great thing to be able to say about your Christian experience, Surprised by Joy. In the book, he explains what he means by that. In his earlier years, he had, on two different occasions, if I remember correctly, experienced, just all of a sudden, with almost without any warning, just a very fleeting moment of pure ecstatic joy. Just overwhelmed him. Just pure, unadulterated joy. And then it left, just like that. And it came for no reason, and just pure joy. And he said the rest of his life, he had been looking for that joy to come back, trying to recapture it. But he said he never thought he would find it in Christianity, and when he trusted Christ, he was surprised by joy. And he discovered that joy that he had been looking for those years. And I think it's a tremendous title of a spiritual experience, Surprised by Joy. I'm thinking about writing a book on my spiritual experience. I'm going to call it Surprised by Misery. Surprised by Failure. I've got several different working titles. Surprised by Defeat. And you know, I have an idea that Simon Peter would write a book about his own spiritual experience, I think he could entitle it Surprised by Failure, Surprised by Misery. For the one thing above all is certain, that when Jesus predicted that Simon Peter would fail and fail utterly as a believer, Peter didn't believe him, and it came to him as a total surprise. And you know, I find a lot of Christians that are surprised by failure, that are surprised by misery and defeat. Somehow, as I indicated, I believe, last night, we get the idea, and I guess we get it from preachers, but we get the idea that if you'll come to Christ, that's the end of your problems. And, you know, we say Jesus will make you higher than you've ever been before and all of that sort of stuff, you know. And we just promise that it's all from now on going to be a bed of roses, no work, all ease, all honey, no bees. You know, from then on out, becoming a Christian just gives you a carte blanche to everything wonderful, and you'll never be depressed again. You'll never have problems again, and on and on and on and on. I remember one Sunday morning in the our worship service, we had a young man, I guess he was 15, 16, maybe, came down to the altar and professed his faith in Christ. And when I presented him a little bit later to the church, sometimes when someone just freshly been saved, you know, just fresh plucked from the vine, so to speak, I like to give him a chance to say something. And I said, "Tommy, would you like to share anything with the congregation?" He said, "I sure would, preacher." He said, "I want you to know, I just feel great. Man, I feel terrific." And he said, "I'm never going to lose this feeling." And I said, "Well, Tommy, that's, you know, boy, I'm glad that you feel so good. And I know how you feel just being saved and all. But I said, son, don't trust in your feelings. And you know, you'll not always feel just like you." He said, "No, preacher, I'm never going to lose this feeling. I'm never going to lose." Well, I didn't want to argue with him. I mean, you know, have a big argument with a new convert right there in front of the church. But I said, "Well, you know, Tommy, but you know, you might not always feel exactly like you." He said, "No, preacher, I'm never going to lose this feeling." So I just let it go. About 3 weeks almost to the day, into my office comes Tommy. I mean, he's dragging. His face is long and drawn, and he is just, well, you can tell that he looks like he's been, you know, through the thick of it. And I said, "Tommy, what in the world's the matter with you, son?" He said, "Oh, preacher, I think I'm lost." He said, "I just don't even believe I'm a Christian." And I sit down, and I said, "Sit down, Tommy, let's start right." Come to find out that he had made a mistake. I mean, you know, he had made some wrong moves and done some things, and he had lost that joy. And, of course, in my broad Christian graciousness, I did not remind him of what he had said just 3 weeks before. But Tommy thought that he had just lost the whole business of salvation because, you see, he was surprised by failure and surprised by defeat. Jesus has said this to Simon Peter. But I want you to notice something. One of the things that Simon Peter said is, "Lord, I'm ready to go with you to prison and to death." And Jesus said, "No." He said, "Satan hath desired to have you that he may sift you as wheat, but I have prayed for you." And I feel like it'd be very helpful for us just to talk about tonight the sifting of the saved, this sifting process that Jesus predict would come into our lives. Now, you know, I can understand why Simon Peter felt it difficult to believe what Jesus said. Did you notice in the preceding verses what Jesus had said? For instance, in verse 28, Jesus said to these disciples, "You are the ones that have stayed with me. You've stuck by me in all my trials. And I appoint unto you a kingdom, so as my Father has appointed unto me, that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom and sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel." Now, isn't that something? I mean, that is one more promise. Jesus said, "Peter, fellas, you're the ones that have stuck by me in all of my trials, and as a reward, I'm going to give you a kingdom, and you'll sit with me at my table, and you'll sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel." That's pretty heavy stuff, isn't it? I mean, you know, you get the idea. You get the idea, man, I have it made. Doesn't it strike you as rather strange that in the very next breath Jesus says, "Simon, by the way, Satan's going to turn you inside out and you're going to deny that you know me." And, you know, Peter can't make that quick adjustment. One minute he's a hero, the next minute he's zero. One minute he's sitting on the throne, and the next minute he's lying flat on his face in utter failure. And so it's not hard to believe that Simon just could not accept what the Lord said. Lord, I'm not going to fail you. Now, I want to tell you something. The reason that I like this story and this incident, it tells me something. It tells me that regardless of how much you love Jesus and how devoted you are to Him, it is possible that that love and that devotion can be temporarily overwhelmed. I don't believe that Simon was making an empty boast. I think he sincerely believed that he was ready to die for Jesus. I don't believe there was anybody that ever loved Jesus any stronger than Simon Peter did. He's the kind of fellow that when he did something, he put his whole heart into it. And I don't believe he was making an empty boast. I don't think he was just trying to brag. I believe he sincerely meant it. Simon was a man who loved Jesus with all of his heart. But listen, what this story tells us is, and teaches me, is that regardless how deep my love for the Lord, and how much resolve I have to serve Him and be faithful to Him, there is the possibility that there can come times in my life when that love can be overturned and the entire tenor of my life can be changed. Doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter how strong you may think you are. And Jesus speaks about the sifting of those who are saved. I just want to say three simple things about it, and we'll try to make it just as brief. And if you'll listen real fast, well, we'll get through before they sublet your room tonight. Number one, the Lord predicts that you and I will be sifted. This is a word of prophecy. He predicts it. He says, "Behold, Satan has desired to have you that he may sift you as wheat." Now, we'll not go into the sifting process. You know what it means to sift. It was a very harsh, rough treatment of the wheat. In order to knock off the chaff, to separate that which was bad from that which was good. And Jesus is saying, Peter, the devil has a keen interest in you. He desires to have you. He's really interested in you. And he wants to take you and harass and hassle you and turn you inside out and sift you just like you would sift wheat. The devil wants to destroy you. He wants to so completely defeat you that you won't know whether you're coming or going. And that's the idea behind the sifting. Now, I'm not going to take any time tonight to try to prove the existence of the devils, but simply to say, I believe the Bible teaches there is a real, actual, real, goodness-forsake person called the devil. I don't understand all about him, and I know there are a lot of things about his activity that it's beyond my comprehension, but I do know this. The Bible makes it unmistakably clear that you and I have an arch enemy, one who is devoted, if he cannot damn our souls, then to defeat us in our Christian lives, and that person is called the devil. I'm a lot like Billy Sunday. Billy Sunday is a great old evangelist of about 60, 70 years ago, and he used to say, I know there's a devil for two reasons. Number one, the Bible says so, and number two, I've done business with him. And I want you to know I've done business with him, and you have too. There is a personality, a spiritual personality, who is committed to defeating us and destroying us in our Christian living. And Jesus said Satan has an interest in you. He takes a real interest in you. And the Bible teaches that when a person commits himself to Jesus Christ, he becomes a primary target of the enemy. And the devil will do everything he can to cripple your Christian life. And Jesus calls this sifting. Now, what I want to show you are three primary strategies that the devil uses in the sifting process. You know, I think it's helpful if we can sort of understand how the devil operates, knowing where he will attack and how he will attack. And there are three things that emerge from this story that I think can be helpful to us. Number one, the devil loves to attack us during moments of crisis or when we're going through some period of stress in our lives. This is one of the most opportune times for the devil to try to knock the props out from our spiritual life. Suddenly we're in a crisis. It may be physical or emotional or spiritual or financial, but we're under unusual stress and strain, a period of stress in our life. And of course, this was what was happening at that moment. The disciples were about to be left behind. Judas had acted strangely and had gone out and left the rest of them. Jesus kept talking about being betrayed, saying he was going to leave them. And it's obvious that the disciples were nervous. They were anxious. They were worried. The Bible says they were arguing among themselves. There was a strife among them. They were going through a terrific time of crisis. They were under unusual strain. And that's when the devil struck, you see. Now, any time that you find yourself under this kind of stress, some big problem all of a sudden has come up in your life, there's something, you're so preoccupied, something weighing down on your mind and it's just eating your life inside, that makes you more vulnerable than ever to the attack of the enemy. You are more spiritually vulnerable then than at any other time, because it drains you emotionally and mentally and spiritually. And all of your energies, you see, are devoted to fighting this stress, and it's very difficult to fight a war on two fronts. And so, you just forget about the devil and the spiritual warfare and such as that, and all of your time and attention and energy is devoted to trying to somehow cope with this problem, and that leaves you vulnerable on your blind side, and that's when the devil will strike. He's a dirty fighter. He'll kick you when you're down, you see. And I've talked with people who've been going through, you know, say some physical crisis, some period of sickness. I was dealing with a couple not long ago, undergoing terrific financial crisis right now, having terrific financial battle. And suddenly the devil has used that. He just grasped at the opportunity to see. And any time that you're in that kind of situation, you become sort of confused and you're not really sharp spiritually as you ought to be. And that's when the devil moves in on you. I like to, you know, it happened that way in the Bible so often. Either right before you go into some crisis, or right in the middle of it, or right when you come out of it, the devil may be waiting for you. You remember Elijah on Mount Carmel, and there he challenges the 450 prophets of Baal. I mean, there is a courageous man. You'd think by looking at Elijah, there is a fellow that would never have any spiritual problems. There is a man that's able to overcome any kind of obstacle. I mean, if you've got enough nerve to stand before all of the people and challenge those 450 prophets and then cut their heads off, you know, that takes quite a bit of nerve. And you know, if you turn the page after that experience, you'll find Elijah running for his life. You remember that story? He got word that Jezebel, the queen, wanted to kill him, and all of a sudden he just collapsed. And he runs. And if you check it out, he runs 90 miles to get away from her. And weary and exhausted, there he is sitting under a tree, wallowing in self-pity, praying that God would kill him. Now, the ridiculous thing is that is, if Elijah had really wanted to die, he could have stayed right where he was, and Jezebel would have obliged him very gladly, you see. It just doesn't make sense. Jezebel said, I'm going to kill you before the sun goes down. The dogs will lick your bones. And he runs 90 miles to get away from him. He said, Lord, I just wish I were dead. And I love what the angel says to him. The angel of the Lord appears and says, Elijah, what doest thou here in this place? Oh, how are the mighty fallen. You would think that after a great spiritual victory like that, Elijah would be able to withstand any temptation. But the opposite is true. After you've had some great spiritual victory, you become more vulnerable. It has drained you. It's just like a physical exertion, just like a football game or running a mile. You are exhausted physically. You're weakened physically. And when you go through some crisis, emotional or mental or spiritual, some kind of strain, it drains you and you are exhausted spiritually. And I just have news for you. Sometimes you'll think, man, I see the light at the end of the tunnel, and it'll turn out to be a train. The devil will attack during periods of stress and crisis. And that's when you need to be on guard spiritually more than ever before. Second strategy of the devil is this. He strikes at our strong points. Strikes at our strong points. Now, you say, well, I just always assumed the devil would strike at our weak points. No, he strikes at our strong points. The reason is because our strong points are our weak points. that make sense? Listen to what Jesus said to Simon. Simon, Satan's going to sift you, and you're going to deny me three times. Why would a man deny Jesus? Why would Peter deny Jesus? Well, evidently Jesus was saying, Peter, you're going to be a coward. You're going to be afraid in the next few hours. You're going to be afraid to have people know that you're with me. You're not going to want to be identified with me. And Simon Peter said, Lord, not me. Now, you might say that about the rest of this bunch. I've been suspicious of two or three of them all along. But I want to tell you this much, Lord. There are a lot of things I might do, but one thing is this, I'm no coward. And I believe him. I think Lord Douglas was right when he called him the big fisherman. I believe Simon Peter had been on that boat fishing all those years. I think he was sunburned and muscle-bound. I think he was every inch a man. I think he was first Hebrew redneck. I mean, really, don't you think Peter was a redneck? I mean, you know, when you read about him. I think if he were alive today, I believe he'd drive a pickup truck with a rifle rack on the back and wear a cowboy hat and vote for George Wallace. That's Now, that's Simon Peter. Simon Peter, not afraid of anybody. I can prove it. You remember in the garden when the soldiers came to get Jesus? Only one man pulled a sword and tried to defend Jesus. Who was Simon Peter? Of course, you know, he went for his head and got his ear. He's brave, but he's a lousy shot. But Peter's saying, Lord, I'm not afraid. I'm ready to go to prison. I'm ready to die. I'll not deny you. You know what Simon Peter was saying? He was saying, now, Lord, I know I've got some weak points. But boy, there's one place where I'm strong. And that's in my courage. I'm not afraid to fight for you. And don't you think it's interesting that that's exactly where the devil struck him? Was any strong point. At the very point that Peter felt he was invulnerable. That's right where the devil attacked. You see, he attacks our strong points because we think that they are so strong we don't need to worry about them, therefore they become our weak points. This is why Paul, when he wrote to the Corinthians, he said, take heed, lest you who think you stand, fall. And to the Galatians, he said, brethren, if someone be overtaken in a fault, you that are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of fear and trembling, considering thyself, lest you also be tempted. In other words, Paul was saying, listen, when somebody in the church, somebody in the fellowship falls into sin, falls into spiritual error, you try to help him up, you try to restore him, but you better do it in a spirit of humility. You better not look at him and say, well, brother, I would never have done that. Because you'll do the very same thing. He said, you think you stand, you hear about this brother who's fallen, and you think you're standing, you think you're strong and established, he said, you better watch out, you'll also fall. I don't know, I couldn't even begin to count the hundreds of Christians that have come to me through the years, and they've started out like this. Preacher, I never thought I'd do this. I never thought this would happen to me. I never thought I would do such a thing. And I know what you and I know what goes through our minds. We hear about some Christian falling. We hear about them getting into some kind of sin and disobeying the Lord and dishonoring the Lord. And we very smugly wrap our righteousness around us. We say, well, I'm not perfect, but brother, that's one thing I wouldn't do. I know I'm not perfect, and I have my weak points, but boy, that's one thing that I wouldn't do. You'd better watch out. That's the very area where you think you're safe and snug and secure. That's the very area the devil will attack you. He attacks at strategic, at our strong points. The third thing is he strikes at strategic people. I want to show you something in verses 31 and 32. And the Lord said, Simon, Simon. Notice how he singles Simon out. Behold, Satan hath desired to have you. Now, the word you is plural. It doesn't come out in the English, but it's the Greek plural, that he may sift you, the plural, as wheat. Here's what Jesus is saying. Jesus is saying, Simon, the devil wants to sift all of you. You see, the devil desires all of you. He's talking about the devil sifting all the disciples. Verse 32, but I have prayed for thee, he drops back to the singular, but I have prayed for thee, Simon, that thy faith, Simon, fail not, and when you, Simon, are straightened up again, you, Simon, strengthen your brethren. Notice how he singles Peter out. But he makes it clear the devil wants to sift all the disciples. And yet he addresses himself to Simon. Why? Well, simply because Simon's the leader. Simon's the key to the rest of that bunch. The rest of those fellows take their cue from Simon. He was the unofficial leader of that group. He was the spokesman. Whatever Simon Peter did, that's what the rest of them would do. You remember after the resurrection, they were sitting around, and Simon said, "I'm going fishing." They said, "Wait a minute, we'll go with you." They always did what Simon Peter did. And the devil knew this. The devil knew, if I want to get all of those fellows, Peter's the key. He's the key. All I have to do is get him, and when I get him, I'll have the rest of them. And I tell you this, this is just my humble and accurate opinion, but I believe that if Simon Peter had not denied his Lord and forsaken him, the rest of them would not have either. But I believe the rest of them did simply because Simon did. You see, he was the key to that bunch. He was the strategic person. And boy, the devil is smart. He knows who has the key to your life. For instance, can you think of anybody tonight? Can you think of any Christian tonight that you look up to and you believe in so strongly that if you heard that they had fallen into sin and denied their Lord, it would really shake you? I mean, it might even cause you to question whether, you know, all of this is really true. It would really hurt you. Can you think of anybody like that? Sure you can. We all know people like that. I know of people. It's happened. I know of people that I think so much of and I look to and I draw spiritual strength from. Man, if I heard that they had fallen into sin and somehow dishonored the Lord and denied the Lord, it would hurt me. I don't believe that it would cause me to, you know, just give up, but there was a time in my life when it would have. Yes, sir. You know, I think this is why people like that in that position, you know, sometimes are under unusual attack of the enemy. And I think about, you know, Max. I think Max has a tremendous testimony ministry here. And can you imagine, you know, what would happen to the ministry, what would happen to so many of the students around, you know, if suddenly, you know, Max denied the Lord. Max denied the Lord. Well, the fact of the matter is, you know, it just doesn't revolve around spiritual leaders. It revolves around anybody. You may not realize it, friend, but you yourself influence somebody. And if you exert any kind of influence at all on anybody, I mean if you exert influence at all on anybody, you better watch it. Because, you see, you may very well be the key to somebody else. For instance, I believe that I'm the key to a big extent to my family. You know, I think suddenly if I were to fall into sin and renounce the Lord or something like this, I think it would cripple my family spiritually to a big extent. You know, no telling what effect it might have on my children. And my son is enrolled in Baylor first year, and he's a ministerial student and wants to be a preacher like his dad. What would happen suddenly? What do you think effect it'd have on him if suddenly I renounced the Lord and quit the ministry, you know, and just gave it up and backslid on God, rebelled? What effect do you think it might have on him, you see? What I'm saying to you is this. You may be the means, and you are, whether you realize or not, you may be the means to somebody else. And the devil knows. And any time you begin to have any influence for Jesus at all, then you become a target. So, those three things. He attacks us during times of crisis or stress. He attacks us at our strong points. And he attacks those people who have influence over other strategic people. Now, we'll not spend nearly as much time on this next point as this. But I do want to spend just a moment on it. First thing I've said is this, that the Lord Jesus predicts that you and I will be sifted. Now, second point, I've got some good news and some bad news. Good news. Did you know that the devil cannot sift you or touch you or hassle you without the Lord's permission? Do you know that? This word translated desired, and I believe it reads this way in the New American Standard, means to obtain by asking permission. Jesus is literally saying, Simon, Simon, behold, Satan hath desired to have you and has asked permission, and I have given that permission that he may sift you. The devil cannot touch a believer unless God gives him permission. The book of Job teaches this. The devil wanted to attack Job, and he had to get divine permission, and God told him where he could touch him and where he could not touch him. And the testimony of Scripture is that the devil can't lay a finger on you unless the Lord gives him permission. Now, you know, that's encouraging. I mean, the devil's just not free to operate on me any way he wants to. Boy, he has to get divine permission. That's the good news. Now, the bad news is the Lord does permit him to do it. And when I really began to think about that, all of a sudden, it startled me. I've never seen it in that light. Do you mean to tell me the Lord could prevent the devil from sifting Simon? Thereby Simon Peter would not deny his Lord. Thereby he would not go through that great tragedy. Do you mean the Lord could have prevented that and he didn't? Do you mean he actually permitted the devil, gave the devil permission? I wouldn't have done that. I have two children, and I know the devil will try to get them just like he'll try to get anybody else. Now, I tell you this much, folks. If the only way the devil could attack my children was by permission from their father, he wouldn't get it. Well, the devil came to me and said, oh, said Ron, let me have your son. I want to turn him inside out. You think I'd say, well, sure, go ahead. Well, I tell you something, I'd do anything in my power to keep the devil away from my kids, wouldn't you? Sure you would. Well, I guess that means then that I love my children more than God loves them. It's interesting, isn't it? You mean tell me the Lord could have prevented that and he didn't? That's right. Friends, the Lord permits the devil to sift us. You say, why? Well, I think there are two reasons. Number one, we need it. It's just that simple. We need it. Peter needed a good old sifting. That arrogant, cocky, stubborn, he needed it. You see, sifting is the... You know, if you're going to be wheat, you're going to have to be sifted. That's all there is to it. Wheat was not worth anything. I mean, you couldn't make bread out of wheat and make it edible until it had to be sifted. It goes with the territory. It's in the nature of wheat. It has to be sifted. You're going to be wheat, right? Or you're going to have to be sifted. Why? You've got to be made clean and pure before you can be made life-giving to others. And Peter had a lot of chaff on him. He really did. I mean, you know, the Lord never quite got through to Simon. And you know, all the way through, Simon's big problem was his pride, his arrogance. Lord, I got it made. I can handle it. You know, in Matthew chapter 16, he finally said something right. He said, Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus said, Blessed art thou. I believe, you know, the Lord was as shocked as Simon was. He said, Blessed art thou, Simon Barjona. You finally said something right. He said, He said, flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father which is in heaven. Now, boy, that was a big spiritual moment. And the very next minute, Simon Peter turns around and starts advising Jesus on the best way to redeem the world. That's what it was. He said, I'm going up to Jerusalem and die. And Simon Peter said, No, Lord, don't do it. No, Lord, not that way. Have you ever known anybody, they have one little spiritual experience and something that makes them an expert? That's the way, they're hard to tolerate, aren't they? They really are. They're hard. You know, somebody's had a little spiritual experience. Suddenly they're an expert on everything. Hard to put up with them. And the Lord had to put up with Simon. You know, Simon had a spiritual experience and suddenly he was an authority on everything. You see, I'm going to tell you something. I believe that the sifting process sort of is the Lord's last recourse. I believe that he will try to remove the chaff from our lives by his teachings, by his word. But if we will not obey the word and allow the word to cleanse us, as he says in John 15:3, I believe then There's only one recourse left, because you are going to be clean, brother. I mean, I am going to see to it that you're fit, and he'll let the devil do his work. And I believe for 3.5 years, Jesus had faithfully, patiently taught, tried to get Peter to see that he had not yet arrived, that he was not God's gift to the world of ministry, that he was still weak, vacillating, and yet Peter thought that he was rich and increased in goods and had need of nothing. And finally, the devil came to Jesus and he said, I want to sift Peter. And Jesus said, you know, devil, you got a good idea there. Now, you understand this is not really what we're saying, but I'm trying to give you the idea. You see, the Lord knew that what Simon needed was a good old sifting. That's what he needs. You see, folks, there are some things you'll only learn through failure. There are some things you'll only learn through failure. There's a book written several years ago. The title of it was Failure, the Back Door to Success. I didn't read the book, but I enjoyed the title. And I just saw it in a bookstore. But I like that. Failure, the Back Door to Success. There are some things that you will not learn until you've been humbled or humiliated. And Jesus said, all right, Simon. All right, Satan. You can touch him. You can sift him. Now, Satan wanted to sift him, to destroy him. But Jesus overruled Satan's purpose, you see, and he wanted to be sifted in order to save him. And, of course, that's where the sovereignty and the majesty of our Lord comes in. Even when the Lord allows the devil to sift us, the devil's purpose is to destroy us. But, you see, the Lord is just letting the devil do his work for him. In other words, he's letting the devil do certain things, but he's causing what he does to work out for a different purpose, a different goal. For instance, Paul's thorn in the flesh was a messenger of Satan. That's what it says, 2 Corinthians 12. Paul's thorn in the flesh was a messenger of Satan sent to buffet him. But God allowed Satan to inflict Paul, but God overruled Paul, the devil's purpose. The devil's purpose was to discourage and defeat Paul, but God's purpose was to get Paul in a humble and receiving attitude so he could receive more of God's sustaining grace. Now, the reason the Lord permits us to be sifted, friend, is because we need it. And you know, Peter wasn't perfect after that, but he never had that problem again. That's right. You study his life, he never again had that problem. That was a sure cure. Now, I want to tell you something. There'll be some times and periods in your life when God wants to teach you something and wants to do a work in your life. And friend, there's only one way that you're going to pay attention. There's only one thing that will really teach you the lesson. There's only one thing that will really get it through to you. And that's when, by the Lord, allowing the devil to sift you. And like I said, I believe that's his last recourse. I think the Lord always first tries to cleanse us by his word. And that encourages me to want to obey his word. I don't want to force the Lord to have to sift me. But the reason the Lord would allow that is because we need to be sifted. Second reason is because others need it. Now, I don't mean others need to be sifted. I mean others need you to be sifted. Notice what Jesus says in verse 32. But I have prayed for thee that thy faith fail not, and when thou art converted, the word doesn't mean have the idea of being saved again. It means when you've regained your spiritual balance, when you've regained your equilibrium. When you come to your senses is literally the meaning. Strengthen thy brethren. The word means minister. Encourage thy brethren. You see, Jesus had selected Peter to be the encourager of those other men. But he said, Peter, you're not fit to lead others. You're not fit to minister to others. Peter, you don't have any patience with failure. You're intolerant of weaknesses in other people because you think you're so strong. Peter, you think you're so righteous and so wonderful and so strong, and you don't have any empathy or sympathy to those men that are weaker. And you have a tendency to sort of be holier than thou. And he said, yep, Peter, I want to use you to minister to them and strengthen them, but you can't do it in your present condition. And the only way that you'll ever be fit to minister to others is if you yourself know what it means to be a failure. So it is. Now, what I'm saying to you is this, that many a time the Lord will allow you to be sifted because others that you're around need what you can do with them and for them after you've been sifted. You understand what I'm saying? You know, I know there are a lot of Christians that live and die without ever having any explanation of why certain problems and tragedies befall their lives. I met a young woman not too long ago and had gone through a terrible tragedy. She said, you know, it wouldn't be so hard to handle if I just had some explanation. Why? 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 I'll tell you what I believe. I believe that someday when you and I stand on the other side and we know as we are known, and we stand there in the presence of the Lord, I believe that we will see the explanation for a lot of our own sorrows and difficulties in the lives of other people. I believe sometimes that the tears we shed water the flowers in somebody else's garden. I think sometimes perhaps the gold that our sorrow, our difficulty may earn is deposited in somebody else's account. What is it that Paul was saying? When he wrote to the Corinthians, he says, death works in me so that life may work in you. In other words, Paul said, I have gone through certain things so that I might be comforted of the Lord, so that I in turn may comfort you with the same comfort. I'm discouraged. There are certain people I would not go to. Now, just being very honest with you, I'm thinking of one of my good friends that I just love dearly. I want to tell you something. If I was having a real problem, I mean a struggle, or maybe if I was having trouble with my children, you know, I wouldn't go to him. I wouldn't go to him. Why? You know what? He has never experienced any difficulty in his own life. He has never had any real problems or struggle. Yet he has. And he has a tendency to, when somebody else is going through some struggle, to say, well, you know, if they were as spiritual as they ought to be, you know, they could handle that. And James says that when we come to God, he upbraids not. That means he doesn't rebuke us. You know, when we come to the Lord and say, Lord, give me enough sense to get out of this, he doesn't say, well, you shouldn't have gotten in that mess in the first place. That's what it means. I went to a person once and I said, boy, I'm in trouble. I'm having a problem. And could you help me? See, he said, yes, but I don't see how in the world you could have been so stupid to have gotten into that in the first place. I never went back to him again for any other problem. You know, I don't want to go to somebody with a broken heart and have them, first of all, tell me how stupid I am to have gotten into that mess. That's what James says in chapter 1. He says, if any man lack wisdom, let him come to God, who gives to all men liberally and will not upbraid them. In other words, God will give you the wisdom without, first of all, preaching a little sermon. And there's some people I just wouldn't go to, but I tell you what, there's some people I would easily go to. You know why? They know. They've been there. I want to tell you, it's very personal, but I think it illustrates something. You remember back in the early 70s, you know, the Jesus Revolution, the long hairs, the hippies, you know, the counterculture. I want to tell you something. I used to drive down the highway, and I'd see one of those long-haired, dirty-looking, scraggly-looking fellows with a beard down to his navel, you know, and his hair hanging down. Hadn't been washed in 3 weeks, with a backpack on there, thumb in his right. And, here I am, a Christian minister. I'd say, God bless you, brother. Why don't you clean up? You know, that's what, as I drive by, there's just something, you know, just something inside me would turn over two or three times when I'd see. I just didn't care for. I just, you know. And I remember we had two or three families in our church that having trouble with some of their kids and like that. And I remember saying with staff one day, well, I just believe that, you know, if they were out, they ought to be spiritual, that wouldn't happen. Well, I want to tell you something. One day, my son, when he reached the age of 14, we woke up one day and he was gone. And we didn't hear from him for 2 weeks. And 14, he hitchhiked to Fort Lauderdale, Florida, strung out on drugs, and came back. When he finally came back with his hair just awful. And that went on like that, off and on, for several years. And you know, it did something to me. And after that, when I'd drive down the highway and I'd see some, you know, boy like that, well, it changed me. I still didn't like it, didn't think that it was right and the proper. But, you know, all I could think about was, there's some mother, father somewhere that's hurting, and there's some boy that's really searching for something. You understand what I'm saying? And what happened is that suddenly I was able to be able to minister to some families in my church who were having the same problems. That's what I'm talking about. I believe that the Lord will at times allow us to go through some trial, some difficulty. Why? So we can minister to others. Because others need it. They really do. And I'll tell you something. God will never allow you to go through some trial or difficulty that He will not, if you will let Him, make that a point of useful service later on. I found that every difficulty I've gone through, sooner or later, the Lord brought across my path somebody who needed what I was able to share with them from what I'd learned. Now, finally, and I just won't even get into this, the Lord not only predicts it, and He not only permits it, but He protects us in it. He says, but I have prayed for thee that thy faith fail not. And when, not if, He said, and when you get back on your feet, strengthen thy brethren. The Lord protects us in this. He may allow the devil to sift us, but He does not desert us. And He said to Simon, He said, Simon, but I have prayed for thee. Did you notice He told him ahead of time He prayed for him? He didn't come to him after it's all over and say, you know, Simon, you didn't realize this, but I prayed for you. No, He told him ahead of time. I think that's good. I think when Simon was going through all of that trauma of denying his Lord, he could hear the words of Jesus echoing in his ears, but I've prayed for thee, but I've prayed for thee. And I like it when Jesus says, and when. See, it's not if you get back on your feet. It's not if you survive this, but when you do, because you will. I'm praying for you. I'm holding you up and sustaining you by my intercession. I'm praying for you. When you get back on your feet, strengthen thy brethren. Now, I want to say this to you. The Lord never sends you down any path that He does not precede you by His intercession. Whatever difficulty, struggle, defeat you go through, God never allows you to go down any road without having, first of all, preceded you down that road by intercession. And what that means to me is that I walk on ground that Jesus already prayed over. And when I walk out this door tonight and I put my feet down on the ground, every time I put it down, I'm putting it down on ground that Jesus has already prayed over. He precedes me by His intercession. And therefore, I know that whatever difficulty, whatever struggle, whatever trial may come in my life, whether it has to do with something relatively minor or something relatively major, I know that my Lord has already been before me. He's already prayed this thing through to victory. And He said, now when you get through this, you'll be a better Christian. And you'll be able to minister and strengthen and encourage your brethren. And isn't that what it's all about anyway? I mean, isn't this what we've said? I want to be an example. I want to minister to others. I want to be able to encourage and strengthen others. And God promises that He'll see to it that you do. So, I want to tell you this. If this has not been helpful tonight, please remember it, for it will be. For there are three types of people here tonight. There are those who have been sifted. There are those who are right now going through some sifting process. And there's a third group. Watch out, brother. I do not know of any Christian that at one time or another hasn't gone, does not go through some sifting process where the devil hassles and harasses you. And where the Lord sort of knocks off the rough edges through it and to make you more like Jesus. So whether you think it's needful tonight, you try to remember it, and I guarantee you one day it will be helpful and profitable to you.